Hey there, and thanks for tuning in to The Curveball, a new current affairs podcast on Jukebox Radio. My name is Leo, and I'm joined by co-host Hugo.
Hi, guys.
Awesome. And today, we're joined by our special guest, Aiden. Hi, Aiden.
Pleasure to be here, Leo.
Fantastic. Today, we're going to be discussing digital ID cards, the Labour Party conference, and the US government shutting down. So we've got a lot to cover in today's episode. Let's get into it. The United States federal government officially entered its third shutdown under Trump's presidency at midnight on October the 1st because Congress failed to pass appropriate legislation for the 2026 fiscal year, I guess.
The Democrats didn't want to give in to the Trump administration's, however they wanted to distribute the money. And when it's a shutdown, it's not like a crisis. It's just like no one's working in the government for a couple of days.
Yeah, so it's like a strike.
Or pretty much it's a strike, but a lot of people are without work.
I've never heard of a government shutting down.
Shut down, what, 2019, I think, was the last time.
And you said this is because of, like, lack of bipartisan support?
Yeah, the Democrats didn't agree with the way the Trump administration wanted to distribute the funds for the year. And they stated that they didn't want to be bullied into accepting their demands. So, at the moment, the US government is not functioning. So
yeah, hundreds of thousands of people have become unemployed. What do you think that does to the country, Aiden?
I mean, in the grand scheme of things, the amount of people that work in the government sector is very small. So it's not necessarily people currently not being without a job that's the main issue. It's more the fact that major issues or anything that does come up won't be able to, well, basically won't have the whole of Congress to sort it out at the moment until an agreement can be made and things return to normal order.
I mean, from the news reports, it's something like 750,000 federal employees have been furloughed and another 700,000 people who have been like classified as essential are continuing to work without any pay because of this like fiscal disruption.
There's also talk of shifting from temporary furloughs to permanent layoffs, which could escalate the human and political cost.
And yeah, so I guess Aiden, as our like pseudo political expert today, how do you think this plays into Trump's wider agenda with the kind of rift between the two parties in the States?
Well, Trump certainly made that rift much larger than it previously was under different presidents. The political rift in America is, well, very different to most countries, even when you look at somewhere like here in the UK, in terms of beliefs and ideologies and culture as well in different parts. I think this at the moment represents quite a big point during Trump's second presidency that shows that the discontent which the Democrats have with the way the Republicans are running it. And I also believe personally that this could be good in a way. They could reach an agreement because they can't just let the government be shut down forever. It will probably last a bit before they can reach an agreement and sort it out and things return to working order.
Fantastic. Hugo?
The Democratic leaders are pushing the narrative that that Republicans and Trump bear the blame of this event. And over the last couple of weeks in particular, including events such as the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and church shooting, I believe.
Yeah, just like systemic violence.
Yeah, systemic violence. The Democrats are really trying to push the blame onto Trump and the Republicans as they deem that Trump's method of leadership is far too indecisive and that not enough is changing for the benefit of the people of the country.
Fair. Yeah, I mean, the president is elected to serve on behalf of the people, and if that means in his eyes, firing like masses and masses of people because he disagrees with them politically or they're standing in his way politically, I think that's going to cause like a real shift in what democracy means in the States.
Aiden, don't you think that Trump is focusing a bit too much on external politics rather than internal politics?
Can you clarify what you mean by external? Do you mean foreign affairs?
Yeah.
I mean, pretty much every US president has had the same argument put against them, but with conflicts around the world, particularly the Middle East, obviously that's a very big global issue, so he has to pay attention to that. He can't just ignore it. But at the same time, it is about getting that right balance between affairs on home soil and affairs abroad. But it's not to the extent of other presidents, like the Gulf War, for example, where full-scale conflict. But it could be argued that Trump is not doing enough to focus on the people in his own country. And adding to what you said earlier about the Democrats shifting blame onto the Republicans, I mean, it's one of the problems with US politics, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Whenever something happens, the first thought is, was it a Democrat? Was it a Republican? Whose fault is it? Rather than, what are the next steps? So
that's a fair assessment, I think. Yeah. Moving on from the United States as we come back home to the UK, obviously we had the Labour Party conference yesterday at the time of recording. Today is Thursday, the October the 2nd. So on September the 29th to 30th, I guess, in Liverpool, the Labour Party had their annual conference. What were the key takeaways from that?
I believe new policy pledges were made, such as a proposal for paid work guarantees for up to 18 months for unemployed youth on universal credit. Another one would be a permanent ban on fracking in the UK was advanced, aligning with green commitments. And there was also an emphasis on tough rhetoric against Reform UK, including criticism of Nigel Farage, debates about human rights frameworks, and in the this is to do with migrant crossings as well.
Yeah. I mean, Keir Starmer literally said, he said, when was the last time you heard Nigel Farage say anything positive about Britain's future? He can't. He doesn't like Britain. There was a really, really strong rhetoric against Reform UK at the Labour Party conference this year, probably in response to the massive protests in London with Tommy Robinson and the increasingly far-right movements in the States to kind of renationalise the UK. Do either of you have any thoughts or opinions about this?
I believe it's a fair argument to make. I believe as a country, we shouldn't be leaning to such extremities, especially in the political aspect. And I believe that though Reform UK makes certain considerably valid points, their method of going about such ways, like such changes in the country, is far too extreme and far too unforgiving to those who are being subject of the change.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. In comments of the Labour Party conference, it's quite clear that Keir Starmer has recognised the threat that Reform poses in the next election. And I think at this point, he's basically acknowledged that Labour are the underdogs, Conservatives are basically out of it, haven't heard anything about them recently. So I would criticise Keir Starmer's approach of just focusing on this other party to the extreme that's basically his main agenda whenever he speaks public now, trying to
dissuade
away from support of Reform rather than actually making improvements and showing what he can deliver, because of course there's a lot of criticism of how he's went about. But adding on to what you said, Hugo, about Farage's policies, whilst some of them are important, of course, such as being able to regulate migration in here, being able to see who's come in, able to see what they've done before. Obviously, it's a safety risk if you let people in, no idea where they've come from, no idea what their beliefs are, no idea what they're going to do. But at the same time, we have an example in the US of what's just happened, of what will happen when you try and mass deport people. It's impractical, doesn't work.
And it sheds a really bad light on our country.
And yeah, you can't just walk into someone's house who's been living here for several years, who has a job, who has a family, who's actively contributing. If it's someone who, let's say, has been convicted of crimes multiple times, then the argument can be made that there's no place in the country if they're not contributing positively. But the way the Trump administration went about is just, in my opinion,
yeah, far too extreme.
Yeah. You're getting rid of positive contributors to society.
It's also, there have been multiple examples of families being torn apart where some members of the family have been deported and others haven't.
Yeah.
So you get that. You get that really.
Shows the inconsistencies. And
yeah.
I mean, the best way forward would be to regulate people coming into the country. But
Yeah, it's, as I said earlier, some of the policies and the views of reform are not baseless. It's just the extent to which they will carry certain policies out and the, let's say, the mercilessness of them, in a way, is far too much for our country to handle, I think.
Yeah.
In my
opinion, without going into the whole what would you do sort of conversation, sort of checks in Calais or something along the lines of that, rather than the slap the Navy in the channel, because we were not going to be shooty at migrant boats. That's a humanitarian crisis. And also, once they're in the UK, there's the whole crisis of there's not much you can do once they've arrived here. So there has to be some form of history checks or interviews sort of a way to earn citizenship or access to the UK, whether it be through work or through something like that. Or
through legal methods.
That reminds me, 1 or 2 weeks ago on an unreleased episode, because we're still piloting, we discussed about the new migrant policies, as in like the one in, one out. So we're deporting those who have come into the country illegally and are not contributing to us as an economy and a society. And we're bringing in migrants who have done their processes legally and will come and contribute and will come and work and just merging with the society.
I don't believe that's the most effective way.
It's very slow.
One, it's slow. Two, the sort of scatter gun effect of you're pulling someone out of somewhere, could be connected to people, could not be, and then you're getting someone else in randomly, throwing them in. It just creates social dynamics where people are losing people and gaining new people, and it doesn't really help anyone. But it's a step in the right direction, and it will stop the net increase.
Yeah, I really think it laid a foundation for further policies.
It's a step in the right direction in terms of the thinking.
I mean, in terms of steps in the right direction, one of Keir Starmer's big points was their proposal to ban fracking in the North Sea, which is a really big... and obviously fracking is a really detrimental process to not only just the environment, because we're burning all this oil and releasing all these greenhouse gases, but it's also really bad for our natural geology. And then you have Cammy Beagnock coming out, who's the current leader of the Conservative Party, is the opposition, saying that they would legally scrap the our net zero goals, which is, I think, a really bad move. It will benefit a lot of businesses because they won't have to be concerned about meeting their carbon goals as much, but it's really going to impact our green economy and advances in technology if the Conservatives come back in and they implement this policy.
Also, building off of that, for the last decades almost, the UK has been seen as a leader in the G7 summits and the movement towards becoming a greener country. And if you just throw that out the window, other countries just will lead by our example, and then I think we'll have quite a big knock-on effect if we decide to throw it out the window.
Yeah,
I agree with the scrapping net zero policy, but not because I support damaging the environment, obviously. I just believe that net zero is a near impossible thing to measure and regulate.
That's properly. Fair.
Yeah.
Of course, that fracking in the North Sea, stopping that, that's a step in the right direction. It will affect industry, but if you can, let's say, renewable energy or nuclear energy to replace that, it's not too much damage done. But it's just the way of calculating whether your net zero, whether your emissions or your company's emissions or waste or whatever matches is net zero, is near impossible to be able to put limits on companies that are correct. It's sort of, it is sort of a made up number.
But don't you think banning certain uses or forms of unenvironmentally friendly methods of extracting gas, for instance, like fracking, would motivate us as a country and the world to pioneer in new technologies and ways to to extract gases, for instance, in an environmentally friendly manner?
I mean, yes, but you can't sort of ban it and then be like, well, what do we do now? You've got to think.
True.
You've got to have a plan in place to be able to phase one out and phase another one in.
So for the final segment of the episode today, we're going to jump into the curveball, where it's a hot topic being discussed at the moment and a little bit of an opportunity for a debate. So obviously Keir Starmer and his Labour government announced plans to roll out digital ID cards to the UK population as an optional, at the moment at least, to kind of, from the Labour Party's words, like speed up governance, decrease the levels of checks that employees need to do for right to work and right to live, and make the country run a bit smoother. I know, Aidan, that you disagree with this kind of policy of ID cards. I agree with the kind of idea of speeding up governance. Why do you disagree with it so much?
Firstly, it's a huge use of resources. I think hundreds of millions it would cost to do this. Secondly, what it's actually doing is already being done with other forms of identification. Is that one of the arguments which I remember you saying to me in one of our conversations was, let's say if you have a disability or if you're blind, you don't have a driving license or a passport. Well, firstly, if you don't have a driving license because you're disabled, you have a disability card or some form of identification. Secondly, do you know what you need to apply for a BRIC card?
Probably a driving license or a passport.
A passport and the big one, national insurance number. You can't work in the UK without a national insurance number.
Yeah.
And you need one to be able to apply for it. So that effectively, it's the same thing. But also, what my main fear is for the future is that putting something like a BRIC card, a centralized system connected to other aspects of your personal life, opens the door to potential increased government intervention into personal lives.
Yeah. I mean, that's very fair. And from like recent polls, over 45% of the population agree with you, right? Given recent numbers, by the end of September, 45% of people surveyed in the UK opposed it, with only just 31% of support, compared to back in June, over 53% were in favour of it. So this has been like an incredibly massive shift between public opinion. But I completely echo your point around it kind of looking like mass surveillance and government control. But Hugo, do you want to jump in?
Building off your point about how much it will cost and how many resources it will take, don't you agree that the UK in the state that we are in now, would be wiser for us as a government and a country to invest hundreds of millions in other aspects where the country needs it currently?
Of course. I mean, it's a system which the government will be able to have an increased savings. An increased ability to track, monitor, and limit. I mean, that's why they're implementing it. They have other... It's not to make it more accessible, as everyone has some form of identification other than a BRIC card, but it's the fact that they make it compulsory. That's what Keir Starmer said, for every member of the UK if they want to work.
Wait, so they're making it compulsory for working and proving your right to work. Earlier in the podcast, you were talking about how you feel that it is necessary, like some of Reform's policies, while pretty extreme, that kind of idea is necessary, like locking down our borders to an extent, controlling migration so we know who's coming in and whether they can work or not. Surely isn't this a really effective way to do that, to prove really easily that someone has a right to work?
No, because they already have other means of checking that, whether it be your national insurance number, which you need to work and apply for it. If an employer, let's say, hires people for a company that isn't hiring people legally, hires people without a national insurance number or identity, pay them in cash off the books, let's say, they're not going to care if you have a BRIC card or not.
And they'll still check if you have one or comply with those rules anyway.
This is true. These are really big questions that we will need to answer. But I mean, I guess it's down to both societal responsibility for making sure, like ensuring people and your employees have the right to work in the UK. But this is just another way to make it easier for employers to check that.
Well, Brad, it is easier to check that. You just check the national insurance number. This isn't making it any easier. And before you go down the argument of saying, oh yeah, if you want to ID check purchasing drinks or something like that, example, people found a way to fake ID cards by making fakes. People will find a way to fake the scanning of Brit cards, whether they be making forged people that don't exist, whether they be using other people's.
Especially nowadays with the use of AI and the development with the use of technology and how we can use it for our own benefits. I think we'll proceed in faking Brit cards faster than we've proceeded in faking IDs. It's so simple in a way to just duplicate something or just merge something or form something, especially online, because you can just edit it all.
Yeah.
I mean, do you deny the fact that it would make, for example, buying a car, buying a house, that kind of thing, harder and more complicated? Like, do you think that this Brit card thing would make, like, proving your employment status harder and more complicated?
It wouldn't really change it at all.
Do you think it would make it easier to prove drinks, for example, if you forgot your driving license and you only had your phone on you?
That's a fair point, actually. They don't let you buy drinks or anything like that if you don't have a physical ID on you.
Exactly. So,
not even allowed to show a picture of your passport.
Yeah, well, that's just, you have to have your ID on you, the same way that you have to have your phone on you with the ID if you're going to do that.
I mean, you're more likely to have your phone on you than you are your ID, no?
Would you say it's arguable?
Well, is it worth several hundreds of millions of dollars, well, not dollars, pounds, invested into a system that is quite invasive?
So, like,
to acknowledge the fact that some people might forget their IDs at home.
And wouldn't you say that if you had the intention to go out and, for example, buy drinks, it's your responsibility to bring your own physical ID with you?
It's so, like saying some biometrics be installed in every house in the UK in case you forget your keys.
So,
yeah, exactly.
I'd like to counter that slightly. Estonia is known for having an incredibly good, like, digital government service because they have really... So, for example, elections and taxes. They have to run all of their elections online because of really strong influences from Russia, and, like, they need to have really high counter-state proliferation measures. So they run their elections online, and they have an incredibly good digital government to minimize voter fraud and to ensure that people can still access services even when there are bombs falling on the country, for example. I think that rolling out a digital ID card scheme, while yes, it is kind of like it's a trade-off in terms of, with at least with the current invention that they proposed, it's a trade-off for perhaps an aspect of personal liberty and freedom, but it's not going to limit, like, what you can do or where you can go. It's going to make it easier and simpler to prove your identity and to do things.
Well, not yet in terms of limiting what you can and what you can buy, where you can go, but it leaves the door wide open and it's incredibly easy to move on from that point. Once you connect your bank account to it, for companies to pay you through that, for example, or once you connect centralized other systems into the government's control, they'll easily be able to. Political censorship. I'm not saying the government's going to turn into tyrants overnight. I'm just saying giving them the power to do that isn't the smartest thing.
So this is kind of comparable to, in the United States, they have this Real ID scheme, and some states support adding your driver's license to your phone as like an Apple Wallet Pass thingy. This is, I think, on the similar level. Do you agree?
No, because there's a difference between having your ID on your phone and having all of your personal or important things connected to an app on your phone that's linked to the government. The government's able to regulate, control, and do what it wants with, practically. I'm not saying they'll instantly start blocking how much meat you can buy, which I've seen online, but they do have the ability to limit your freedoms, and it could potentially be used for political censorship for people that oppose the current government, or it could be used for things. Yeah.
Would you say that they'd have access to our personal information anyway? I mean, if we all have a national security number or something like that, they would be able to access that anyway, regardless if it was an app or not.
Yeah. I mean, the government recently passed legislation with HMRC that allows HMRC to access people's bank accounts to take money from them.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, with stuff like that, it's not in the government's control. Whilst they do have an agreement with HMRC, they don't have an agreement with every other bank company.
But HMRC is the government, though.
Well, they don't have agreements with... It's in the company's rights to be able to protect their users' data. And they wouldn't be able to simply access people's bank accounts to regulate them now, as they would be if it was connected to your brick card or a digital ID to the same extent.
So kind of what I'm getting from that is you think that the idea of democracy in the UK is slightly derailing then, if we can't trust the people we have democratically elected around the country.
No. I mean, it's the same with most governments in the world. Whilst, yes, you can trust them, I don't believe they're going to be dictators. You shouldn't give them that tool, because if you give them that tool, then it will be used. It will be used in the future, whether it be for good, whether it be for bad, whether it be cases like the social media controversy where people are getting years in prison for comments.
They made multiple years ago, yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah.
That's all we have time for today on The Curveball. And we can't wait to see you next week. So thank you for tuning in.
Thank you very much.